Now back to our story.
The second big heading from Daily Dose of Terror: financial crisis, pandemic, defense, and DHS. The first interesting, scary note, and it will tie into what we're going to get into in a little bit. U.S. will default in 2009. This written by Greg Nixon. Some of the articles below are a few weeks old, but still timely, and he agrees with the conclusion of Jesse's Cafe, which we'll get to in a second, that the United States will have to default on its debt. I see this possibly before the summer of 2009. How this will play out is of the utmost concern. I will continue to watch for signs of the U.S. military releasing a virus to start a flu pandemic. Martial law and quarantines may be the only way for the elites to manage the financial crisis. So, to the aforementioned Jesse's Crossroads Cafe.blogspot.com, in 2009, the U.S. will be forced to selectively default and devalue its debt. We've seen estimates that next year the U.S. will have to finance a $2 trillion annual deficit. They may be able to push it further into the next administration than that by the forbearance of the world, but not by much. We'd expect a significant drop in treasuries by 2011 at the latest. It should be obvious to anyone that we're approaching the apogee of the treasury bubble, with the credit bubble having already broken. When the Treasury says they're facing unprecedented challenges in financing the U.S. public debt next year, that is an understatement. And you can link to others and also interviews. I believe this is from dandeliansalad.wordpress.com. Will the U.S. default on its foreign debt? A nice long interview with Michael Hudson. But if we move to Forbes, Washington's $5 trillion tab, fighting the financial crisis has put the U.S. on the hook for some $5 trillion, a report says. So far. For all the fury over Treasury Secretary Henry Goldman Sachs Paulson's $700 billion emergency economic relief fund, it seems downright puny when compared to the running total of the government's response to the credit crisis. According to CreditSites.com, a research firm in New York and London, the U.S. government has put itself on the hook for some $5 trillion so far in an attempt to arrest the collapse of the financial system. Last little bit on the EconoCrash tip, Associated Press: failure of auto industry could set off catastrophe. Advocates for the nation's automakers are warning that the collapse of the Big Three, or even just General Motors, could set off a catastrophic chain reaction in the economy, eliminating up to 3 million jobs and depriving governments of more than $150 billion in tax revenue. So that's, of course, why we're now calling for another bailout. The fourth and final reposting from dailydoseofterror.blogspot.com: pandemics, missile defense, and DHS to monitor shit. First from ABC News. And we've already broached this idea, but in a pandemic, who gets to live? As if wars and economic crises and natural disasters weren't enough, here's a challenge for some future president that few people even want to think about. Someday, perhaps soon, a president will have to decide whose lives are the most important to save and whose lives are, quote, non-essential. This isn't going to be a doomsday story, because most people will survive the next influenza pandemic, which some public health experts believe is past due. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when, and one study from Harvard estimates that the pandemic will kill somewhere between 51 and 81 million people, mostly in developing countries. Hundreds of organizations and institutions around the world are developing plans for dealing with the expected pandemic, and one challenging theme is begging for more public discussion. Some people will be more important than others in fighting the disease as it quickly spreads around the planet, and many more will be left to pretty much fend for themselves. And there's hits and links and things and searches, the next influenza pandemic. And again, that's coming from ABC, Who Gets to Live? Bill Gertz writes up on WashingtonTimes.com, Inside the Ring, Missile Defense Working, Air Force Lieutenant General Henry A. Obering, that's O-B-E-R-I-N-G, outgoing director of the Pentagon's Missile Defense Agency, said on Wednesday that U.S. missile defenses are working and he hopes President-elect Obama will continue the multi-billion dollar programs once he is briefed on them. Asked if current U.S. ground-based and sea-based systems are workable, General Obering said, "Absolutely. Not only are they workable, they've been proven in combat in the Middle East." And he said this in a farewell interview with defense reporters. A spokesman for Mr. Obama, Dennis McDonough, said last Saturday that Mr. Obama discussed missile defense with the Polish president, Lech Kaczynski, but that the president-elect made, quote, no commitment to the interceptor base. Mr. Obama, quote, supports deploying a missile defense system when this technology is proved to be workable, said spokesman Mr. McDonough. Now, there's links in there. You can hit it because, of course, the story came out first. It was like, Obama met with the Polish president. They said, of course, yeah, missile defense, good deal. And then it came out, and of course, Obama's people said, hey, wait, no, no, there's no commitment. But of course, Obama is fully on board. Moving to Danger Room, and of course, noting quite well from Greg Nixon that the Department of Homeland Stupidity is going to start tracking shit. Homeland Security will track fertilizer buyers. The Department of Homeland Security has proposed new regulations that would make it harder to buy ammonium nitrate, an agricultural fertilizer that can be used as a bomb-making ingredient. In a notice issued late last month, the department proposed new rules that would tighten restrictions on the sale of ammonium nitrate. Of course, ammonium nitrate was used as an ingredient in the 1995 Oklahoma City false flag bombings. More recently, fertilizer bombs have made an appearance in Iraq. The switch to homemade explosives, however, may be one sign that military-grade explosives have become harder for insurgents to come by. There you go, conflating homegrown supposed terrorism with Iraqi roadside bombs and Department of Homeland Security, and you are the terrorist. Boston Business Journal notes that Raytheon has unveiled their 300th surveillance tower. Raytheon's reached an important milestone in its production of persistent surveillance towers, the Rapid Aerostat Initial Deployment RAID system provides surveillance support for use in both war and peacetime. Now the U.S. Army has 300 of them. The Waltham, Massachusetts-based defense contractor said the towers support intel, surveil, and recon missions. They are used by the U.S. military in Afghanistan and Iraq, and are also used for domestic border surveillance both in the U.S. and U.S. ally nations. The towers use infrared sensors on an elevated stationary platform. Raytheon officials say the towers perform a crucial function in protecting American soldiers. Finally, under this massive heading from Daily Dose of Terror, Financial Crisis, and More, Russia rejects U.S. missile proposals. Again, this from Reuters. The Kremlin on Wednesday rejected U.S. proposals aimed at easing concerns over a missile defense system in Europe and said it would try again to resolve the row once Barack Obama is in the White House. Russia says the planned U.S. system will threaten its national security and that the administration of George W. Bush, which leaves office hopefully in January, has failed to allay its concerns. Quote, Russia is ready to cooperate with the U.S. on European security, but considers the proposals that were sent are insufficient. ITAR TASS news agency quoted an unidentified Kremlin source as saying, and there's the link to the English translation of the article for you. Now let's have a paranoia attack. This from the Associated Press. Paranoia on the rise, say experts. If you think they're out to get you, you're not alone. Experts now say that paranoia may be a lot more common than previously thought. British psychologist Daniel Freeman, for example, said nearly 1 in 4 Londoners regularly have paranoid thoughts. A British survey of more than 8,500 adults found that 21% of people thought there had been times when others were acting against them. Another survey of about 1,000 adults in New York found that nearly 11% thought other people were following or spying on them. Experts warn that paranoia can be stressful and result in more social isolation, hostility, and possibly even crime. Still, some say a little paranoia could be helpful. A professor in Texas said it's a dangerous world, so it's good to be on guard. two books from British psychologist Daniel Freeman. The old one, Paranoia, The Psychology of Persecutory Delusions. And there's also articles from the Daily Mail. And you can read about paranoia on Wikipedia. And the new book, again, from Daniel Freeman, is called Paranoia, 21st Century Fear. And that's all there for you. And you can even hit the old book up on Google Books and read from it. Unless you're scared, do you think? Well, I think they say it's written on the inside of a George Carlin album called You're All Diseased, and it says paranoia. You only have to be right once to make it all worthwhile. Moving now to still contested elections, the Senate race in Alaska. So, 2 days ago, on Wednesday, they're doing recounts, and it's Ted Stevens, convicted criminal, and Mark Begich, mayor of Anchorage, brother to HARP investigator Dr. Nick Begich. So, 2 days ago, on Wednesday, at the end of the recount day, Begich is ahead by 3 votes.
And there is breaking news at this hour. Absentee ballots counted today in Alaska, and they are not all counted, not by a long shot. The ones that have been counted have put Democrat Mark Begich in front of Republican Senator Ted Stevens by exactly 3 votes. 3 votes. In Alaska, the Division of Elections was supposed to count most of the 90,000 early and absentee ballots today. The convicted felon, Senator Stevens, had led the Democrat, Mark Begich, by about 3,200 votes before today's canvassing. The final tally not expected before tomorrow, but the Anchorage Daily News and other news organizations reporting about 43,000 of those votes have been counted. The lead right now, Mark Begich, the Democrat, 125,019 votes. Senator Stevens, Republican incumbent, 125,016 votes.
Then the update came after the second day of counting that Begich is leading now by 814 votes.
After trailing for more than a week, Democratic Senate candidate Mark Begich has taken the lead over Republican Senator Ted Stevens. Begich came into the day trailing by more than 3,200 votes. But after a tally of some early and absentee ballots, the current mayor of Anchorage now has an 814-vote lead. State officials say there are an estimated 30,000 ballots remaining to be counted. They will be counted on Friday and then finished up next week. In a statement released late Wednesday, Begich said he is cautiously optimistic. The soon-to-be 85-year-old Ted Stevens has been in the U.S. Senate since 1968. Just last month, he was convicted of lying on Senate disclosure forms about work done to his home. If Begich were to overtake Stevens, he would become the first Democrat to win the Senate seat from Alaska since the mid-1970s. This Alaska Senate race is one of 3 Senate races across the country that still has not been decided. Orla Reese, the Associated Press.
There it is, Mark Begich, ahead by 814 votes. And again, I can only think that having somebody like Begich in would be a positive development. Returning to the Associated Press, and another disturbing example of corporatism, the state and the corporations. And when you're talking about big business collusion with the state, it's hard to beat Walmart. Walmart partners with the Army Reserve to recruit you. Walmart Stores Incorporated has signed on to an Army Reserve program that allows the company and the Army to work together to recruit and train people interested in serving in the military and working for the giant retailer. Walmart, the world's largest private employer, has more than 1.4 million employees in the U.S. An agreement signed Tuesday obligates Walmart to interview and consider all qualified participating soldiers for employment after they complete military occupational specialty training. Lieutenant General Jack C. Stoltz, chief of the Army Reserve, was in Bentonville, Arkansas, for the Veterans Day signing of the agreement. When a reserve soldier who works at Walmart is called to service, the company can draw on 1 million or so citizen soldiers to help identify a qualified replacement to work in the soldier's place. The arrangement is expected to lower costs of recruiting and training for Walmart. The Army Reserve launched the program in April and is already linked with numerous companies, including Lowell-based J.B. Hunt Transport Services Incorporated, Sears Holding Corporation, Manpower Incorporated, and Northrop Grumman, among others. The program also helps the Army find trained professionals. Now you know that when the shit goes down and they're trying to force vaccinate you, they're going to tell you to go to the Walmart, which now will be already staffed by soldiers. A shifting of gears, but disturbing nonetheless, and this is quite the little update from a story that goes way back to October 2006. This initially from thinkprogress.org. That's right, it's Mark Foley. He's back, and he says, "I'm not a pedophile, because the pages were almost 18. Mark Foley finally broke his two-year silence after the revelations about his lurid IM conversations with congressional pages. Foley conceded that his behavior was, quote, extraordinarily stupid, but throughout the AP interview, he stayed on the defensive, one, saying he's not a pedophile, and two, the children didn't say no. It was, of course, a momentary lapse of judgment, but he carried on the computer conversations for months, you know, asking about masturbation, sex, and other details. And there is a video from the West Palm Beach television station, WPTV.com, NBC5, Mark Foley, "I'm not a pedophile. The kids were almost 18.
When your lawyer, your West Palm Beach lawyer, David Roth, in fall of 2006... said that you were an alcoholic and you had been abused by a priest. That was in fact true, wasn't it?
It was all true. Everything David Roth said that day was true, despite the fact that so many people assumed we were making it up to save my political hide. You know, first and foremost, I resigned, so there was no saving me, if you will. But what hurt me more was that my constituents, my friends, would believe that I would falsely accuse someone of such an act in order to redeem myself. And so there were people in the community that immediately came forward and said, I've never seen him drunk. I don't believe this happened with the priest. Well, you know, I was very careful and meticulous about my public image. So I was not a fall-down drunk, as it were. But I was drinking in excess. Late at night, I would drink. I would sit at my desk and drink at home, not in the office. And that's where I believe a lot of our struggles come from. Those things you do behind closed doors that people don't get a chance to see. They see the perfect life. They see the life they emulate and they wish they had. We all do. We all look at people and say, wow, they have it made. But we don't know what happens.
But can you understand some of the questions? Because here you are on a caucus for children's rights. Mm-hmm. Here you are, a homepage that protects, that is, it touts you as an advocate to protect children, and you're sending emails to minors that are, I mean, they're not pretty. I don't know if you've ever reviewed them in the last 2 years. They're just ugly.
No question.
And so people would say, wait a minute, all of a sudden he's going to say he's an alcoholic and he's an abuse. We've heard this before.
Right.
So, you know, can you understand where people are coming from? And why didn't you say something before? Would it have been helpful for you to have said, I'm not only protecting children, I know why I want to protect them. I was abused by a member of the clergy.
No question. If I could replay it, that was the reason for my advocacy. People may find that false. But when I was 12, I was abused. So I recognized that pain and the suffering. But at the same time, you know, people are juxtaposing emails to 17-year-olds to putting it in the common parlance of calling it pedophilia, which is absolutely wrong. They were like drunk dialing, drunk text messaging. They were wrong, and I assume full responsibility. I'm not trying to excuse my behavior. But I can understand why people would immediately say, well, it's, well, there's a culmination of things. It's not just the alcohol. We weren't using that as an excuse. David was trying to give context to what had happened in my life. I wish to this day I would have stood up. There was a time a Boston Globe reporter approached me about the priest molestation. And at that time it was Boston, I believe, 96, 98, somewhere in that time frame. And she came up to me because I had been born in Massachusetts and I was like a ex post facto member of the Mass delegation. She said, what about the priest scandals? And I immediately retreated and said, oh, that's for the church to deal with. The church at the time was blaming victims for making this stuff up. I wish to this day in reflection I could have turned back to that reporter and said, let's sit down because I have a story to tell. I wish I would have confronted those demons. But there was a lot of hesitation because my parents had such deep faith and I didn't want to let them down. I didn't want to let them believe that a man of God could have done this to their son. And so you keep it inside yourself. You hide it from everyone because you feel like it may have been my fault. And you try your best to move forward, ignoring that it happened. When you're 12 years old, the priest is telling you, this is healthy, this is good. And if you tell anybody, I'll kill myself. So your life is instantly changed. Doesn't make it right. I regret to this day that incident and what I've done. But I can't change history.
And of course, hit the flashback link at the bottom of the page. Going all the way back to Monday, October 2nd, 2006, this from Propaganda Matrix and Paul Joseph Watson, Elitist Perversion Far Deeper Than Foley. And of course, you can read all about whether it's the homosexual prostitution inquiry ensnaring VIPs with Reagan and Bush, the story in the Washington Times, or whether it's Jeff Gannon, or human trafficking, child sex slavery, Mark Dutroux, DynCorp, Halliburton. It's the conspiracy of silence. Elitist perversion far deeper than Mark Foley. Now, I mentioned it just a little bit ago, and now we're here. This coming from Wired Science. I subscribe to this podcast. It's a video podcast, and it's usually how we create this indoor environment for these cool, cute little penguins at this California museum. And then, finally, the other day, I get in my iTunes, served right up to me, Wired Science, Plum Island Bio Threat. Wired Science visits Plum Island Animal Disease Center, which for the past 50 years has been the United States' front line against foreign animal diseases.
Plum Island for 50 years has been the front line, what we call agro-defense, you know, protecting the U.S. livestock, protecting the animals, and doing the research on foot and mouth disease and these other foreign animal diseases. It's critical that we can better understand what it takes to detect these diseases and prevent them from spreading.
You can, you know, bring an economy to its knees by infecting its food supply.
A $2.8 to $4.2 billion impact to the economy. The NBAF is unique because Plum Island is the only facility of its type that does foreign animal diseases. And some of those zoonotic diseases we have no vaccines for. In fact, we barely know enough about these diseases. And to be able to study them effectively, we need a BSL-4 for what we call large animals or livestock. There is no existing facility like that in the country. Biosafety level 4 is based on the pathogens that we work on, which have high risk of life-threatening disease to humans. And some of those diseases that go from the animals to humans are devastating to humans. I mean, humans can die if we get those diseases. We need to protect the workers that are going to be working on those specific pathogens because there is no vaccine that they could take. There is no countermeasures. The risk of a foreign animal disease of entering the country are only going to increase, such as the Nipah and Hendra virus. We've seen outbreaks in Australia and Asia, so we need to have that capability.
Plum Island does not have proximity to research capabilities. It doesn't have proximity to workforce, no feasible evacuation. Anybody that's ever driven on the Long Island Expressway knows there would be no way.
The decision maker does not need to pick the site that had the least environmental impact. He didn't need to be aware of what those impacts are.
A disturbingly light and glib video from Wired and Wired Science. Plum Island bio threat. But if we hit the flashback to April 13th of this year on MediaMonarchy.com, accidents at Plum Island Disease Lab acknowledged from the Associated Press, the only U.S. facility allowed to research the highly contagious foot and mouth disease, experienced several accidents with the feared virus. And there are links there to WorldWar4Report.com, Rinse.com, and of course Wikipedia. Now, as I mention every time we mention Plum Island, proven by the book Lab 257, that they basically created Lyme disease from ticks that they got from Lyme Island, Connecticut, and released it to you. Isn't that nice of them? It reminds me, again, it's always nice to get a comedic, satiric take on something Patton Oswalt said.
You know, I am completely pro-science, anti-creationism all the way, but sometimes science is fucking wrong and gives us shit we don't need, like 63-year-old women giving birth. Why don't I just come out and go, hey, we made cancer airborne and contagious. You're welcome. We're science. We're all about coulda, not shoulda.
Break, my friends, and that was appropriately enough a song called Breaker from the Duluth, Minnesota trio known as Low, L-O-W, and that's from their most recent record last year's Drums and Guns. And here on the extra extended special B-side episode of episode 99 of MediaMonarchy.com, we are, of course, unfortunately going to be discussing guns more than we are drums. But moving into the econo crash, unemployment, protests, transparency, and theft. First from ABC News Unemployed Nation. Carol Steinbreckers, a 55-year-old mother of three who, like many Americans, has spent most of her life working hard to provide the best for her family. But today, she's part of another group of Americans, one that is growing larger every day, the unemployed. In the first 10 months of this year, the nation's employers have cut nearly 1.2 million jobs, and the unemployment rate is now at 6.5%, the highest it's been since March 94. The Department of Labor released new data showing that October was the 10th straight month of job losses, with another 240,000 jobs lost just last month, with a link to thetrumpet.com to read about October being the 10th straight month of job losses. Now, if we move to UAE International by way of blacklistednews.com, rubbing it in your face out very much in the open these days, you hear the name Rothschild thrown out sort of mythically. But right here we have Baron David de Rothschild sees new world order in global banking governance. Baron David de Rothschild, the head of the Rothschild Bank. The Rothschilds have helped the British government since financing Wellington's army to fight the French in 1815, said, quote, "We provide advice on both sides of the balance sheet, and we do it globally. There's no debate that Rothschild is a Jewish family, but we're proud to be in this region. However, it takes time to develop a global footprint," end quote. And of course, banks will deleverage, and there will be a new form of global governance. There it is, in your face, Rothschild calling for global financial world order. iReport has mounting protests in Iceland. A protest took place outside the Icelandic Parliament building. Motorcyclists protested in a very symbolic manner, revving their engines in tandem, churning their tires till the Parliament building seemed to go up in smoke. Afterwards, a lone protester managed to make his way up to the roof of Parliament and raised a Bónus flag. Bónus is Iceland's staple grocery store, whose owners have been highly controversial in the past. The act was testament to what seems to be happening in the halls of power. Iceland needs help, but it's not for sale. And there's a nice poster that I grabbed from the Bónus website, the grocery store in Iceland. And there is an interesting slideshow, again from iReport, that shows the smoke seeming to engulf the Parliament building. If we jump to another one from Paul Joseph Watson, the Federal Reserve hides the destination of $2 trillion in bailout money. The Federal Reserve is facing a lawsuit after it failed to comply with a congressional demand for transparency and disclose the destination of at least $2 trillion in bailout funds, underscoring once again the failure of top-down socialism and the folly of trusting the foxes to guard the henhouse. Quote, "The Federal Reserve is refusing to identify the recipients of almost $2 trillion of emergency loans from American taxpayers or the troubled assets the central bank is accepting as collateral," end quote, from Bloomberg. If we move to the AFP, $150 billion more for AIG. The U.S. government announced Monday an expanded bailout for insurance giant AIG of more than $150 billion as the Treasury tapped into emergency funds originally set for banks. The latest bailout plan, the largest in U.S. history, came as AIG burned through billions of dollars of cash and reported a third quarter loss of $24.47 billion. The original Federal Reserve rescue of $85 billion in mid-September, at the time the largest in corporate history, was expanded by $37.8 billion just a few weeks later and involved the government acquisition of a 79.9% stake in the troubled insurer. But AIG, the world's largest insurer before the global credit crisis, has continued to suffer from soured bets on credit default swaps and other complex financial instruments amid a financial crisis that accelerated in October. Of course, it didn't start in October. They just decided to tell you about it in October. Under the revised program for AIG announced Monday, the Treasury will replace the entire previous package with a larger, longer-term $152.5 billion program, including a $60 billion five-year loan and $52.5 billion to buy up distressed securities. AIG, of course, involved in insurance in the World Trade Center building. AIG, again, set up by Cornelius V. Starr, Ken Starr's uncle. Of course, earlier this week, on Tuesday, we celebrated, for lack of a better word, Veterans Day. A scathing piece put up by winterpatriot.blogspot.com. Come, let us celebrate our monsters. 90 years ago, on November 11th, 1918, World War I finally ended. Of course, it wasn't called World War I at the time. It was called the Great War. How could anyone have known it would be the first of many? Who could have guessed that barely 20 years would pass before the beginning of another one? The day when peace finally arrived was given the name Armistice Day. Thereafter, it was commemorated every year with solemn ceremonies and sacred vows of never again. In many English-speaking countries, November 11th is now called Remembrance Day, and it's still commemorated every year with solemn ceremonies and sacred vows. But in the USA, November 11th is now called Veterans Day, and its primary function is to glorify the president, even though he's a deserter. Its secondary function is to glorify fools and killers who put more stock in shameless and transparent propaganda than in their own consciences, or who had no conscience to begin with, who cared more for obvious lies than they did for humanity, or who hid gleefully behind those lies to enjoy the thrill of killing without any legal consequences, who claimed to be Christians, but somehow managed to ignore all the commandments, but still believed their faith in Christ would see them through the pearly gates no matter how many innocent people they slaughtered, and who now suffer the inevitable consequences, though they suffer far less than their innocent victims. In civilized countries, on November 11th, they mourn their dead. In America, we worship hired killers. What should a day, or whether... Rather, what should be a day of somber reflection becomes an endurance test. Can you survive 24 hours of it without retching? I can't. I never could. And every year it gets worse and worse. Just once in my life, I'd like to hear the following conversation. Do you support the war? No, I don't support the killing of innocent people for any reason at all. Do you at least support the troops? No, I condemn killers for hire, no matter who hired them. And again, a scathing piece from Winter Patriot. Come, let us celebrate our monsters. Now, of course, a little update, a little opposite side. This from Raw Replay. Co-hosts of ABC's The View argued over whether the proper way to honor veterans on Veterans Day was complaining or griping or pointing out what the trials and tribulations have been because of this war.
Well, first of all, here, you know, it's Veterans Day. Yes. So yes. A salute to everybody in uniform, past and present. It's extraordinary.
Front page of any newspaper about Veterans Day, and I find that very offensive because we have lost over 4,000 American soldiers, male and female. We have the cost of the war is $570 billion, and the body counts of Iraqis is between 900 and 100,000 people.
So
it's a terrible war. And we should take
this is not the day for that. Look, today we have 23 million Americans fighting right now who served our country. They have spent their lives dedicated to our country. 1.8 million of them are women. Today is a day to just honor their quiet courage. Our freedoms rest on their shoulders.
About the boys and girls in the war.
Just take a day.
I am saluting them by talking about what the trials and tribulations have been because of this war.
Neocon Hasselbeck on The View, and we haven't heard from The View in quite some time, but as long as we're talking about TV talking heads and the outrageous things they say, again from Raw Replay, our good buddy Joe Scarborough. We just mentioned him last week, and of course the dead page in his office back when he was in Congress, Lori Klausutis. But this time, what he's doing is, well...
The nature of this campaign has really been the steady nature of Barack Obama, the steady nature of David Axelrod, the not-so-steady nature of Robert Gibbs, only because he went to Auburn. But these are good, decent, steady men that don't go around flipping people off or screaming, fuck you, at the top of their lungs. I suggest that you missed the Jay Carney story. Now, that was the Jay Carney story.
I didn't use the word.
Honey.
So Mike Barnacle. The chances are good that Rahm Emanuel is going to have to become a member of the Obama campaign.
Chances are better that without the 7-second delay.
There you go. MSNBC broadcasting censored profanity on Morning Joe. Scarborough was talking about Rahm Emanuel when he used the F word. We got an update from thinkprogress.org. Now, of course, Joe's now guarded by a 7-second delay. Of course, what Mika Brzezinski was laughing and moaning about there in the background. Yesterday, MSNBC's Joe Scarborough accidentally dropped the F-bomb while live on air. After apologizing, Scarborough said, "My wife's going to kill me when I get home." The show will now have a 7-second delay to protect against future outbursts. An MSNBC spokesman said that no other shows on the network will have the delay, which was reportedly a mutual decision. Former MSNBC morning host Don Imus had a similar arrangement on his show. From the lighthearted to the darkness, first of two times hitting the fantastic and getting better all the time, Corbett Report. James Corbett out in Japan doing amazing work on CorbettReport.com. It's the first one we're going to hit under my heading 9/11 updates, videos, details, and explanations. Details emerge on new WTC7 collapse video. A source connected to the previously unreleased footage of the collapse of World Trade Center 1 and World Trade Center 7, which suddenly appeared on internet video sharing site VEOH.com last weekend, has revealed details about the footage to the Corbett Report. According to the source, the videos available on the internet came from a DVD that was compiled from raw footage taken in New York on 9/11. The video on the web has not been edited or manipulated in any way from the footage on the DVD, although the replay of each collapse has been slowed down by half. The source indicated, however, that the raw footage had been edited before it was put on the DVD, thus explaining the sudden cut from a close-up of the North Tower to a long shot of the entire building, with the collapse already underway. As the Corbett Report previously reported, the videos were released anonymously on the internet on November 1st, 2008, with no further information. Now, there's nothing for me to play audio-wise for you here, but of course you must watch the video, and what we did know at the time that I was posting this is that this would just be the first of new video coming out from 9/11, and we'll get to that in just a moment. However, we're going to jump to 911blogger.com and Pilots for 9/11 Truth. They now have their full, I believe, 50-plus minute video attack on the Pentagon. Pilots for 9/11 Truth brings you analysis never seen before regarding the attack on the Pentagon. Highly technical analysis presented in a way the layman will appreciate and understand. A 757 reported to have caused the damage at the Pentagon on 9/11 is analyzed based on topography, obstacles, flight data, physics, and witness statements. I won't play a clip for you, but again, that whole hour documentary is up there for you. Pilots for 9/11 Truth, attack on the Pentagon. Interestingly, and seemingly out of nowhere, apropos of not exactly any new event or any new person speaking out, be it Willie Nelson or Jesse Ventura or Best Actress Oscar winner or who knows, UK TV News explains 9/11 conspiracy theories. This from Raw Story, but the UK's independent television news, ITN, dedicated a short segment of a Monday broadcast to briefly explain several core tent poles of the 9/11 truth movement.
The events of September the 11th, 2001 changed the face of global politics in a few short hours, and in the same time, they launched an internet phenomenon as the blogosphere began to question the official account, often implicating high-level agencies within the US government. With new figures showing almost 150 million web pages devoted to 9/11 conspiracies, here are the big three so-called plot holes in the official version. One theory is that the collapse of both the Twin Towers was caused not by the impact of the planes and the subsequent fires, but by controlled demolitions. Theorists point to the uniform crumbling of individual floors in each tower. More recently, it's been suggested the nose cones of the two 757 jets may have acted as shaped charge warheads. Another theory suggests that one of the planes did not, in fact, crash into the Pentagon, as reported. Major evidence in support, say the theorists, the crash site contained very little debris, and the hole created in the side of the building was much smaller than would have been made by the impact of a 757. The theories are fueled by the FBI's apparent refusal to release nearby security footage of the incident. Questions continue to be asked about the fate of the plane which crashed in a field in Pennsylvania, apparently the result of a cockpit invasion. Many bloggers believe the plane was in fact shot down by a US fighter plane, and a story of passenger heroism was concocted to boost American morale. Eyewitnesses attest to debris falling from the sky, supporting the theory the plane exploded in the air, not on impact with the ground. With all these theories, motivations for the alleged cover-up range from an embarrassed US government disguising the fact it had been inadequately prepared, to the attacks being perpetrated by US authorities themselves to justify subsequent conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq. One certainty, while the internet continues to grow, so will the pages and pages devoted to the so-called truth behind 9/11.
Strangely absent was any attempt to summarize questions surrounding the collapse of World Trade Center 7, a highly significant event to 9/11 truth activists, still rife with questions even after the recent National Institute of Standards and Technologies report. And that, again, is coming from Raw Story, who do seem to have a somewhat not negative view of 9/11 truth and will cover stories from time to time. Such as this one. And this was actually a big, long extract from Limited Hangout Peter Lance and his book Triple Cross. It's from 2006 and it's coming out in paperback soon. But Raw Story pulls out a pertinent bit, and we're going to read a slightly extended piece from that. Attorney General contender carries 9/11 related baggage. I couldn't decide whether to save this under my coming Obama-sia massive posting, or put it in the 9/11 update, so here it is in the 9/11 updates. Attorney General contender carries 9/11 related baggage. Monday's New York Times reported that former Deputy Attorney General and 9/11 Commissioner Jamie Gorelick, G-O-R-E-L-I-C-K, was a candidate for Attorney General in the new Obama administration. Five-time Emmy-winning investigative reporter Peter Lance details a shocking but little-known story about Gorelick involving the loss of a key al-Qaeda operative. And again, this is an excerpt from the 2006 HarperCollins book Triple Cross, soon to be published in trade paperback. Quote, on December 16, 1994, agents in the FBI San Francisco office made an extraordinary seizure. Muhammad Jamal Khalifa, MJK, Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law and former roommate, was captured at a Holiday Inn, Morgan Hills, California. If this arrest had been fully investigated by the FBI and the Justice Department, it might have led to the seizure of 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, KSM, and stopped, quote, planes as missiles plot dead in its tracks. But what followed was a series of missteps and bad decisions at the highest levels of state and justice departments that had a catastrophic impact on America's ability to cut short bin Laden's jihad against America. At the center of the decision-making at the time was Deputy Attorney General Jamie Gorelick. Even if the feds were savvy enough to see the value in questioning him, however, they never got the chance. On January 5, 1995, a decision was made by Secretary of State Warren Christopher and supported by Deputy AG Gorelick that arguably ranks as one of the most profound intelligence errors committed by any U.S. official in the years leading up to 9/11. Quote, Jordan is aware of Mr. Khalifa's presence in the United States, Christopher wrote to Attorney General Janet Reno, and has asked for our assistance in sending him to Jordan so that he may be brought to justice. To permit Mr. Khalifa to remain in the United States in these circumstances would potentially be seen as an affront to Jordan and at odds with many of the basic elements for our cooperative bilateral relationship and potentially undermine our longstanding and successful policy of international legal cooperation to bring about the prosecution of terrorists. Christopher's legal theory seemed part of a determined effort by top officials at Justice and State to craft an exit for Khalifa. Nonetheless, the very next day, Gorelick, serving in Janet Reno's absence as acting attorney general, sent an expedite letter in support of Christopher's deportation request, thereby expediting Khalifa, never talking to him, never investigating his ties to KSM, the quote-unquote mastermind of 9/11, and so, therefore, on to OBL, the quote-unquote head of Al-Qaeda. That's Jamie Gorelick, and she's up for the Attorney General role in the coming criminal cabinet of the Obamasiah. More unseen new 9/11 footage finally being released by the FBI and the DOJ. This from Steve Watson. The FBI and the Department of Justice has released 10 new videos relating to the events of 9/11, 3 years after a Freedom of Information Act request for the footage was submitted. The newly released videos show footage of the attack on the Twin Towers in New York on September 11, 2001. Some of the videos were originally seized by the FBI in the hours after the attacks had taken place. Others were handed to 9/11 investigators or discovered throughout the course of the investigation. The videos were secured by FOIA attorney Scott Hodes, H-O-D-E-S, under instruction from his client, Mr. Scott Bingham, B-I-N-G-H-A-M. Bingham has uploaded some of the footage to YouTube and has set about writing blogs on the videos at pentabom.com. That is P-E-N-T-T-B-O-M. Let's listen to one.
It is the worst thing I've ever seen in my entire life. The whole right side of the top right of the building is gone. Oh my God, I just got an explosion on it. Oh my God, it's exploding. I just got it on video. Jesus Christ. Oh my God. It is the worst thing I've ever seen in my life, Mom. It's like the end of the world. The other building, just caught on fire. It's gone!
That's the pertinent bit of audio that I can play for you. The other 9 videos, otherwise you're going to have to go watch yourself. And they're interesting. However, at this point in the game, I definitely have to ask why. Or why it matters. Because again, none of these are bombshell. However, it goes to show that work is being done with FOIA requests, and that will get more and more and more. I don't poo-poo this discovery, but I can't pay tons of attention to it right now. However, let's wrap this up and put it into perspective. Bingham himself writes on pentabom.com, "This is the first bulk release of videos from the Pentabom investigative file. More will come later. How much later, I don't know. But we requested 64 of 84 items on the menu, and we now have 10 new items." Bingham was previously successful in securing the release of CCTV footage from the Pentagon, the Citgo gas station, and the DoubleTree Hotel, which he documented on his website, flight77.info. And I have the link back for you when that DoubleTree video was released. It's actually one of my bigger hit archive pages on MediaMonarchy.com, the DoubleTree video. However, none of these videos provided clear footage of the impact of Flight 77 in the Pentagon. Although it was Bingham's FOIA lawsuit that forced the release of the only known footage from the Pentagon and the surrounding area on 9/11, government watchdog group Judicial Watch took the credit and released it to the mainstream media networks. And there's a link to frustratingfraud.blogspot.com, and you can read more about that battle of credit between Bingham and Judicial Watch. During the course of Bingham's FOIA request, he discovered that the FBI was withholding at least another 84 surveillance tapes pertaining to the attacks and subsequently requested the release of all the withheld footage. Returning back to CorbettReport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, REPORT, CorbettReport.com, another UN official goes public on 9/11 doubts. At the recent second Osaka 9/11 Truth International Conference on November 1st, 2008, Corbett Report conducted an interview with Etsuko Chida, a United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees worker who was in Kandahar on 9/11. In this stunning interview, she questions the official 9/11 conspiracy theory, raising the points that Osama and Al-Qaeda were CIA-founded and funded, and that it's more beneficial for the U.S. if boogeyman Osama is not captured.
Here I am at the Osaka version of the 9/11 Truth Conference, and I'm talking to one of the attendees. Could you introduce yourself for the viewers?
Okay, my name is Etsuko Chida. I work for United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, and I was in Kandahar on 11 September watching the incident on BBC in Kandahar.
So, of course, the attack on Afghanistan was justified by 9/11 and Osama bin Laden's supposed complicity in that attack. What can you tell us about the sense of people in Kandahar and in Afghanistan at the time about Osama bin Laden and his ability to pull off something like 9/11?
You know that I guess that today in the movie it also says that, like, you know, that Taliban was protecting Osama bin Laden. Actually, you know, I'm not sure if they are, how to say, they are actually, you know, the positively, you know, that the supporting Osama bin Laden or not, because Osama bin Laden was actually put by U.S., you know, the CIA, to fight against Soviet, you know, that the politics, and then apparently that Osama bin Laden has been in Afghanistan, so he started to, you know, of course, started to have his own life and so forth. So Osama bin Laden and the highest, you know, that the authority of Taliban in Kandahar, they had, you know, the marriage relationship. I think that the Taliban's leader's daughter was like third, you know, the wife of Osama bin Laden or something. And I think Osama bin Laden's, I think some daughter or son is married to, like, the, you know, that his I mean, the other leader's son or daughter or whatever. So they apparently made that, you know, that the kin relationship. And the many Afghans, I mean, like normal, you know, Afghan people, that the, because of the, you know, that the culture of hospitality, they, you know, didn't oppose that the people, you know, like the staying there. But I heard many people complaining about, you know, that like Saudi Arabians and the, you know, the different foreigners are now coming to, you know, that the in Afghanistan, and they are kind of, you know, like the militant power and very, you know, that how to say. Making some, you know, commotions inside Afghanistan, and they didn't like it. But then, you know, that they are guests anyway, then they are foreigners, so they didn't, you know, protest. But then, actually, you know, that they didn't like that, the fact that those people were brought into the country. And also the Taliban themselves, I think they are not really, really positively promoting, you know, anyone, just like because, you know, they made this, you know, the, how to say, the coalitions. And also that I guess the, you know, that the Taliban is very, very poor. They really don't have any money, and then you can see that what type of weapons they had. We laughed when America started bombing, because we even doubted if they have, you know, the airplane or the helicopter can fly. It was really poor. Yeah? So that's why that the, you know, that we knew that they, I mean, Osama bin Laden has the, you know, that this the background of that, also that, you know, Saudi fund. So, you know, that definitely they needed Osama bin Laden for the purpose of money, I believe. But then also that and then I really don't think, you know, that actually I really myself suspect that it's actually U.S. who needs Osama bin Laden more. And then that, you know, like that shown in the film, I really think that you know, that Bush administration, especially Bush family, I think that you know, in the relation of the oil, they must have the personal, I think that you know, the beneficial relationship between them. Otherwise, I can't, how to say, I mean, can't explain why that, you know, like right after that, this 9/11, when the, you know, that the air was all controlled by the U.S. government, it's Osama bin Laden's family who were only allowed to leave within 24 hours, you know, to leave the United States. And then that also that, the, you know, like the white, like Saddam Hussein, he was really in the, you know, somewhere that's very difficult to find. And then they still located him. But then Osama bin Laden, they, you know, they knew that where he was exactly. And then, like, you know, kind of allow them to leave. So I just, you know, that I don't know what is going on, but apparently it's clear that I think Bush has some, how to say, the benefit by making him alive. Yeah.
More great work from James Corbett. Another UN official goes public on 9/11 doubts. Head spook Michael Hayden says Osama is alive, but he's kind of worried about his security. This is coming from ABC News. Osama bin Laden is alive and, quote, putting a lot of energy into his own security, the director of the CIA, General Michael Hayden, said. He also claimed, without providing details, that the U.S. intelligence community has disrupted an attack, or rather had disrupted an attack, quote, that would have rivaled the destruction of 9/11. Oh, my God. A senior intelligence official said Hayden was referring to the 2006 liquid bullshit bomb on airliners plot that was fucking foiled in London. No tickets, no passports, no bombs, no liquids, no nothing. Bullshit. Thrown out of court. Patsies. That's what he's referencing. American and its friends have taken the enemy... America and its friends have taken the fight to the enemy, Hayden said, in a broad round of efforts to fight Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda suffered serious setbacks, but it is a determined, adaptive enemy unlike any our nation has ever faced. Without directly referring to the CIA's offensive being the operative word, blitz of unmanned missile attacks in the tribal areas of Pakistan, the CIA spookball said the U.S. had successfully isolated the Al-Qaeda leader bin Laden, referring to him in the present tense, saying, quote, he appears to be largely isolated from the day-to-day operations of the organization he leads, Hayden said in a speech delivered to the Atlantic Council.
This fight, this ideological fight, is the deep fight. That's the battle for hearts and minds, and it has a very deep time horizon. But over the past year or so, there is clear and mounting evidence that we have real cause for optimism. Some hardline religious leaders are speaking out against Al-Qaeda's tactics and its ideology. And polling has shown that support for Al-Qaeda and bin Laden is falling in many predominantly Muslim countries. In fact, more and more Muslims are pushing back against the senseless violence and flawed worldview of Al-Qaeda. Credible, influential voices are refuting Al-Qaeda's twisted justification for murdering innocents. These voices are tapping into doubts about Al-Qaeda that have always been there. People understand that most victims of terrorism are Muslim, and they ask a simple question. What justifies this? The answer from Al-Qaeda is one that a vast majority of people in the Islamic world simply now don't espouse. They don't support bin Laden's caliphate. They don't want to be governed as the Afghan people were governed by the Taliban. Even today, as we speak, in New York City, one of the most prominent voices in Islam, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, the keeper of the two holy places, is right now sponsoring and attending an international symposium on religious tolerance. I've always said that the civilized world will win this fight when we win the war of ideas. And so these developments are very, very promising. And I should underscore, this conflict of ideas requires authentic voices. And in the world as we find it, in this conflict as we find it, authentic voices are Islamic voices. And what I've just referred to are Islamic voices speaking out against Al-Qaeda. I can assure you, although there has been press speculation to the contrary, I can assure you that the hunt for bin Laden is very much at the top of CIA's priority list. Because of his iconic stature, his death or capture clearly would have a significant impact on the confidence of his followers, both core Al-Qaeda and these unaffiliated extremists throughout the world. This is an organization that has never been through a change at the top. For 20 years, bin Laden has been the visionary, the inspirational and harmonizing force behind Al-Qaeda. Whether his deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, could maintain unity in the ranks is a genuinely legitimate question. The truth is, we simply don't know what would happen if bin Laden is killed or captured. But I'm willing to bet that whatever happens, it would work in our favor. Killing, capturing, disrupting al-Qaeda's senior leaders wherever they may find or seek sanctuary is absolutely essential to thwarting attacks on the West. That's the key lesson from 9/11. Our understanding of this enemy and what it will take to defeat him changed on that day. Never before have we faced an enemy so completely committed to our destruction and so completely irresponsible with human life. Al-Qaeda is willing to sacrifice both its own operatives and the Muslims for whom it professes to fight. This enemy, unprecedented in our history, requires a response that also has no model in our past. Let me remind you, one of the defining objectives of Al-Qaeda's theory of war is to erase the distinction between combatant and non-combatant for themselves and for their victims alike. And that distinction between combatant and non-combatant has been an inviolate distinction in the laws and morals of the civilized world. And so this war presents us with operational, ethical, and legal challenges that we as a nation have not faced before, and at CIA, we have been at the center of this nation's response to that challenge.
Head spook, Michael Hayden speaking bullshit to the Atlantic Council, neocons, and that whole video is up on CNN. We're going to move now to the first of what I think right now we're holding off on the Obama Saya, because there is a lot of other news to go over other than the distraction of which new puppet or phony patsy frontman shopkeep shill is going to take over. However, an interesting bit of political theater, of course, took place this last Monday, November 10th, and it made me have a little parody title. And I even went and looked at the original poster and tried to copy the tagline, but I don't know how well it worked out. However, with apologies to Rob Reiner, when Barky meant Bushy. Can two puppets meet together in the Oval Office and convince the public that they actually run anything? From CBS, President-elect Barack Obama and President Bush gathered for their first face-to-face meeting last Monday, November 10th, an Oval Office session that came during an historic shifting of power to a new administration. Neither the incoming nor the current president spoke to reporters at Obama's arrival or departure Monday afternoon. Bush walked Obama to his limousine as he left. Taking a bit of prerogative, the president-elect put his left hand on Mr. Bush's back as the two couples entered the diplomatic reception room. There's a lot of play-acting involved when a president-elect of the opposition party is received at the White House by the outgoing president, notes CBS News White House correspondent Mark Knoller. It's my prerogative.
You look at a scene in the south lawn of the White House, the south portico, arriving about 12 minutes early as they arrived over Reagan National Airport, which is a short 12 to 15 minute ride from Northern Virginia to Washington, D.C. We want to hear from you for the next couple of minutes. The next time we'll see President-elect Obama, Michelle Obama, President Bush, and Laura Bush will be as the president and the president-elect walk along the colonnade, which is adjacent from the executive mansion, to the Rose Garden as they enter the Oval Office, but right now there'll be a private meeting between the four. What are the top priorities for this presidential transition? 202-585-3885 if you voted for President-elect Obama, and 202-585-3886 if you supported Senator John McCain. For all others, 202-585-3887. A little bit of background on this house. The cornerstone was laid back in October of 1792. And it has been the home of every president since John Adams, celebrating its bicentennial in 2000 when the Clintons were in the White House. And as part of the peaceful transfer of power, as part of our Constitution, we're seeing that unveil today and over the next 70-plus days as the Obama administration prepares to take office. But for today, this is also designed to be a personal tour of the residence with Laura Bush and Michelle Obama. And a look at, for the first time for Michelle Obama, what the private quarters looks like. There are, by the way, 132 rooms in the White House, 35 bathrooms, 6 levels in the residence. And in case you're counting, there are 412 doors, 147 windows, 28 fireplaces, and 8 staircases.
Let's get down to the serious business now. This coming from the mouths of U.S. Northern Command, NORTHCOM, and by way also of DailyDoseOfTerror.blogspot.com, NORTHCOM.mil, IndieMedia.us, NORAD and NORTHCOM run Vigilant Shield 09 drills on November 12th through the 18th. We're soaking in it. North American Aerospace Defense Command and U.S. Northern Command will participate in Exercise Vigilant Shield 09, November 12th through the 18th. The focus of VS09 is on homeland defense and civil support. The exercise will include scenarios to achieve objectives, exercise objectives within the maritime, aerospace, ballistic missile defense, cyber, consequence management, strategic communications, and counterterrorism domains. VS09 will run concurrent with other DoD-sponsored and international exercises to more realistically test the synchronized response of federal, state, local, and international mission partners in preparation for homeland defense, homeland security, and civil support missions in the U.S. and abroad. Concurrent exercises include STRATCOM's Global Lightning 09 and Bulwark Defender 09, Canada Command's Determined Dragon, California National Guard's Vigilant Guard, and of course the State of California's Golden Guardian. VS09 is a command post exercise. During a CPX, many of the forces involved in the exercises are notional, and most of the real forces and equipment are not deployed from their home bases. NORAD is the binational command charged with the airspace warning and control, missile warning, as well as maritime for the United States and Canada. Formed in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks of 9/11, U.S. NORTHCOM is responsible for homeland defense and civil support missions. Terror drills, more terror drills, concurrent terror drills. I've heard jets flying overhead all day today here in the Pacific Northwest, and we, of course, had the biggest, largest ever earthquake drill in California yesterday. We'll get to that in just a second. First, a bit of scary speculation from ICANHASTRUTH.blogspot.com. Nuclear attack on London and U.S. between November 12th and 18th? I post this here not to install any fear, but to raise the consciousness frequency higher so that people can avert anything dodgy going on that will cause severe humanitarian and/or ecological loss. Please only read this if you love the planet and its life. If you're fearful of the above headline, please don't be. I'll explain why you shouldn't be at the end. Let's hope I'm entirely wrong on this one, but I think that all the signs are there for a global false flag attack of some sort between the 12th and the 18th of November 2008. There is the flashback to April of this year on MediaMonarchy.com. National level exercise, 8 straight days of terror drills. And if we move to the Deutsche Press Agency, the DPA, we, of course, you may have heard about this one, the Great Southern California Shakeout.
The students in Ms. Linares' class dropped to the ground and got under their desks for the big one. Except this shaker didn't really happen, and everyone involved was acting. The largest earthquake drill in the United States cast more than 5 million people across Southern California. It included schools, hospitals, business, and government.
If this earthquake would have happened in reality, there would have been buildings coming down. We know that there would be no water now in certain areas. There would be problems with the fire departments having enough water to put out the fires.
Dubbed the Great Shakeout, Bishop Alemany High School in the San Fernando Valley was just one of the schools that took part in the drill for the mock quake. Students sported make-believe gashes and burns. They played as the injured or dead for first responders.
I mean, it's a really big deal. There's firefighters and paramedics all over the place, and this is really serious.
The point is this. Seismologists think there's a good chance that an earthquake with a magnitude 7.5 or greater will strike this part of the state within the next 30 years. This animation shows just how big of an area it would strike. Researchers estimate it would cause billions in damage and kill almost 2,000.
We're really trying to change how people think about earthquakes, to change the culture about earthquakes in Southern California, because we mostly say, it's inevitable, there's nothing I can do about it, I'm just not going to think about it.
And to literally jar the point home, they brought in this earthquake simulator. Simulate a 7.8 trembler.
I think I would have been very prepared.
with all the videos that we've seen on our school's channel, Alamany Today, we are ready for that.
Definitely.
Many of these teens lived through the devastating 1994 Northridge earthquake, but barely remember it.
Yes, everyone is taking it as if it's a really real emergency, and we're trying to be as serious as we can.
The drill is meant to shake out the belief a Southern California quake won't happen again in their lifetime or anyone else's. John Mone, The Associated Press, Los Angeles.
Over 5 million Californians ducked and covered and held Thursday as they took part in what was billed as the largest public emergency drill in U.S. history. Some 5,000 first responders and emergency managers were also involved in the Great Shakeout Drill, which was designed to simulate the effects of a 7.8 magnitude quake on the San Andreas Fault across the densely populated area of Southern California. There's a lot more here to read about and link up to. The drill in which people were supposed to dive under desks, cover their heads, and hold on was to be followed by a Get Ready rally in which people would learn about the other aspects of quake preparedness. There was also a 3-day conference of earthquake experts planned and even 2 computer games, one called Aftershock, with a link to aftershock.net for you, and another called Beat the Quake. That's at dropcoverholdon.org. Beat the Quake. Some 3 million students in L.A. and Riverside County schools are among the 5.2 million participants in the drill. According to research published in April, there's a 99.7% chance that a magnitude 6.7 or stronger quake will shake California within the next 30 years. The southern end of the San Andreas Fault hasn't moved in 300 years, yet historically it moves on average every 150 years. That's not as important, and that's not what we're trying to note right here. What we are trying to note is the massive indoctrination and desensitization of terror drills and the militarization and the federalization of everything local and state that you had to rely on. NORAD and NORTHCOM are running major terror drills right now. November 12th through the 18th. I will hopefully keep you updated as we find out more on this. Unfortunately, I don't have a whole lot of info. Again, there are links to NORTHCOM, and I believe if we hit up the link to indymedia.us, there is one from Major William Fox and Captain Eric May dating back to October 14th. Now, definitely, of course, some say that every little thing that comes along, people like Eric May are saying, oh my God, this is it, it's going to be the 9/11 to be false flag, and it's people crying wolf. However, these things always have the funny way of, if you basically shine a bunch of light on them, chances are nothing suspicious is going to happen, so then people, of course, think you're crazy because it didn't happen. They do point out, frighteningly enough, in the article Vigilant Shield in Joker's Gone Wild, and of course tying in with transfer of power, South Ossetia, infuriated Pakistanis, Iran, Syria, and on, once an urban area has been designated an exercise target, speaking of all these massive terror drills, that designation increases its odds of actually experiencing a future false flag attack. It takes considerable resources to corrupt an area, and false flag insiders like to get a return on investment. Since Houston, Chicago, Portland, Seattle, and Phoenix have all been prepared in prior exercises, they remain especially vulnerable. In addition, Vigilant Shield will probably add new areas in Northern California to the potential target list. One more time, my friends, I will tell you, NORAD and NORTHCOM and STRATCOM and more are running Vigilant Shield terror drills November 12th through the 18th. Shifting gears and shining a light on the corrupt drug war, if we move to the AFP, an important but not very well noticed statement from the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, says that our own DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, who of course visit MediaMonarchy.com quite frequently, Bolivian president says DEA encourages drug trafficking. And again, this from the French agency press. The United States on Friday, last Friday, November 7th, rejected as patently absurd charges by Bolivian President Evo Morales that the U.S. government is encouraging drug trafficking in Bolivia. The charges that have been made are just patently absurd, State Department Deputy Spokesman Robert Wood told the Daily Press briefing in Washington. We reject them categorically. And I link to state.gov, November 7th, for Mr. Wood's rejection. In La Paz on Thursday, the 6th, Morales accused the U.S. government of encouraging drug trafficking as he explained his decision to banish the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, with a link to the LA Times for more. Wood said the Bolivian government will only hurt its own people. This is Wood, quote, "The U.S. has had good cooperation with the Bolivian government over 35 years with regard to counter-narcotics cooperation. Should the Bolivian government decide to sever its working relationship with us with regard to counter-narcotics, it's going to impact the Bolivian people. And we're going to continue to look for ways to do what we can to counter their narcotics in the region," he said. So basically he said, if you sever ties with us, your people are going to get hurt. And even though you're severing ties with us, we're going to continue to look for ways to do what we can to counter the narcotics in the region. That means counter the people who aren't on the fucking payroll. With the military industrial complex that brings in the drugs. Evo Morales, a staunch opponent of the Washington government, said the staff from the U.S. agency had 3 months to get the fuck out. Because, quote, "the DEA did not respect the police or even the Bolivian armed forces. The worst thing is, it did not fight drug trafficking, it encouraged it," end quote, the Bolivian leader said, adding that he, quote, had quite a bit of evidence backing up his charges. Presidential Minister Juan Ramon Quintana presented a series of documents and press clippings at a news conference, which he described as object data that had influenced Morales' decision to suspend DEA activities. Quintana said Morales was ready to present the evidence to incoming U.S. President Barack Obama, quote, "to prove the illegality, abuse, and arrogance of the DEA in Bolivia." What do you think of that? If we return to Raw Story, Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, nets a nice little secret 25-year monopoly on natural gas in southern Iraq. Royal Dutch Shell Oil Company and the Iraqi Oil Ministry have struck a secret, as of yet non-binding agreement that gives a monopoly over southern Iraq's natural gas to the energy giant. It marks the first time in over 35 years a Western oil company has played a major role in the country's most lucrative industry. Signed September 22nd and obtained by the UPI, United Press International, the Mooney Press, the heads of agreement document, quote-unquote, basically a legal framework for a contract, delegates Shell sole access to the reserves for the next 25 years with an option to extend that term. Royal Dutch Shell says the arrangement gives it exclusive rights to all natural gas runoff produced by oil exploration operations in the southern portion of the country. However, like so many other major industrial contracts coming out of Iraq, the process used to reach an agreement is being questioned. And I'll link you to uslaboragainstwar.org for more on the questions about these agreements between Royal Dutch Shell and southern Iraq. So will they get their 25-year monopoly? We shall see. A different story from Health Day News and from the WashingtonPost.com. This made me think of Clockwork Orange. Brain scans show that bullies enjoy your pain. Bullies may actually enjoy the pain they cause others, a new study using brain scans suggests. The part of the brain associated with reward lights up when an aggressive teen watches a video of someone hurting another person. but not when a non-aggressive youth watches the same clip. This, according to the University of Chicago study published in the current issue of Biological Psychology, and I link over to sciencedirect.com. I'm not sure if you can get the full report, but you can get a pretty good breakdown and the abstract of the study, which says, quote, or at least this from Gene Desity, a professor in psychology and psychiatry at the University of Chicago. In the university press release from news.uchicago.edu, quote, aggressive adolescents showed a specific and very strong activation of the amygdala and ventral striatum, an area that responds to feeling rewarded when watching pain inflicted on others, was suggested that they enjoyed watching pain. You can also link to themoderatevoice.com for more. Unlike the control group, the youth with the conduct disorder did not activate the area of the brain involved in self-regulation. The medical, or rather the medial prefrontal cortex and the temporal junction. Did you get that? Well, we'll get this. The study compared 8 16 to 18-year-old boys with an aggressive conduct disorder to a group that didn't show unusual signs of aggression. All participants underwent functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, while watching videos in which people endured pain accidentally, such as when a heavy bowl was dropped on their hands, and intentionally, such as when a person stepped on another's foot. And again, this was the way they sort of broke and trained Alex in Clockwork Orange to turn him against the violence, but ultimately it didn't work, and he loved it. Loving violence brings us, of course, back to Police State USA, and generally in the alternative media, we usually get to say, "We told you so." This from the Denver Post. Undercover cops were among the unruly at the Democratic National Convention in Denver. And as I note, staged terror takes many forms. Again, this from the Denver Post. When a Jefferson County deputy unleashed pepper spray at unruly protesters on the first night of the DNC, he didn't know that his targets were undercover Denver police officers. Now, the ACLU of Colorado is questioning whether the staged confrontation by police pretending to be violent inflamed other protesters or officers during the most intense night of the four-day event. You can read the ACLU's letter to the Office of the Independent Monitor in PDF there for you. The protest occurred August 25th at 15th Street and Court Place near Civic Center. There's a video for you. Police ultimately arrested 106 people, the highest number of arrests in a single day during the convention. According to a use of force police report obtained by the ACLU, undercover Denver detectives staged a struggle with a police commander to get pulled out of the crowd without blowing their cover. The commander knew they were working undercover, and the plan was to pull them out of the crowd and pretend they were under arrest so protesters would be none the wiser. A Jefferson County deputy, unaware of the presence of undercover police, thought that the commander was being attacked and used pepper spray on the undercover officers. Staged attacks. Two flashbacks for you. Top secret weapons to be used at political conventions. That was back in July. And of course, police accused of using provocateurs at the summit. That being last August 2007 in Montebello, Canada, of course, when RCMPs were in the crowd dressed up like protesters with a peaceful group, but they had rocks in their hands and they were going to start some shit, and that's how the cops beat the shit out of real protesters. You got provocateurs in the group fucking it up. Whether it's foundation-funded wreckers who are very skilled and precise at breaking up groups and seeding paranoia and playing one in against the other, you've also got the grunts on the ground who just know how to get into a group and throw a rock and get the fuck out. They like to beat people up. Finally, on this extra extended epic episode, B-Side 99, MediaMonarchy.com. Since everything's better now that we've got the Obamasiah, last weekend was a weekend filled with stupid animal stories. Stupid animal stories, each being a link to three of the main stupid animal stories of last week that got all kinds of attention because, of course, Barack Obama's in and it's morning in America and everything's going to be great and the money's all fixed and it's good. And We, of course, first had the question, oh, the burning question, of what kind of dog the Obamas are going to get. The other really funny pet story was the White House dog Barney bites a reporter, which would be funny if we weren't, again, in such a dire situation. And finally, did you see the funny video of the deer that got a fucking pumpkin stuck on its head and it run around? I mean, God, shit's funny. Send that in the home video, man. However, there's a more important story. Let's try one that will actually affect your life very soon. It's microchipping. Lost cat found thanks to its microchip. Hey, guess what? You're next.
We have another sort of a happy ending here. Ivan the cat is home again.
Yeah, after quite a journey, Ivan went missing from his farms and home in April and was found 5 months later in Mankato, almost 65 miles away. Ivan's a lucky cat because his owners had him implanted with a microchip. It's a procedure that costs about $40 and is getting more popular all the time with dog and cat owners.
Ivan is an indoor-outdoor cat in his Farmington neighborhood, popular for keeping rabbits out of gardens.
Everybody knows him. He's out and about and here and there. They all know who Ivan is.
When Ivan didn't come home from his rounds one day in April, his family suspected the worst.
We assumed that a coyote or fox or something had gotten him, and he showed up in Mankato on MEA weekend in October, October 17th.
A woman in Mankato found a skinny Ivan eating her cat's food in her garage.
It's fairly small.
A microchip like this one, implanted just under Ivan's skin, allowed a vet in Mankato to track Ivan's owner in Farmington. Invergrove Heights Animal Hospital showed us how an animal gets chipped.
It's a quick poke, and it's all done. This is one of our universal scanners that will read most microchips. The microchip number was found, and that can be used then to call a number and identify the owner. It is very user-friendly. It is non-painful for the animal. It's fairly inexpensive, and it does help us track down a lot of owners.
When Ivan finally tracked down his owners, he knew just what to do.
He ran inside. He checked everything out, and he went upstairs. He had to check out his spot right away and slept for about 2 days, I think.
Can't blame him. Ivan's 2 years old. He originally came from the Last Hope Animal Rescue Program. So I guess you could say his good luck seems to travel with him.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
Yeah. Quite a story.
Ivan the Wonderful.
Six-month vacation man.
How about it?
That's from WCCO. A long-lost black cat had the good luck to cross paths with others in Farmington who put a chip in its shoulder. And you can, of course, link to the National Animal Identification System and read all about that. And again, it's a good idea. That sounds like a good idea. And then we should put a chip in Grandma because she's got Alzheimer's. She kind of wanders around. We should also probably put a chip in some of those people who are HIV positive and, you know, them African and backward countries, and we can keep track of them, too. And then, I kept losing my ID that had my RFID chip in there at the DMV. But I think I'm just going to get it put in my arm, and then I can just get buzzed in. And I can get buzzed in and go to work when I go to Walmart because they got that new deal with the Army Reserve, and I got the job at Walmart, and I can fight in Iraq, and then I can come back here, and I can give people injections because of that big storm. And then when the Al-Qaeda knocked out all the computers and that shit that happened in D.C. when Obama was getting sworn in, man. Let's look at the list of creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. We had Apple Computer Incorporated out of Colorado Springs, Colorado, Google, November 14th, 2008, Army Drill. That's today, that's now, that's happening. Fermilab, dhcp.fnal.gov, Fermilab, out of Chicago, Googled human race, break two species, BBC, and of course, in the future, you're going to be a Morlock. You won't get to be an Eloy. National Defense University out of Andrews, Maryland. They're reading about U.S. shame still stings 40-plus years now after the Mille massacre. FEMA out of Springfield, Missouri. Newborn dies while in custody of Homeland Stupidity. Oh, we were just talking about the Drug Enforcement Administration. They were visiting from Arlington, Virginia. The U.S. Department of Energy out of Montgomery Village, Maryland. They were reading about Azam the Operative and his new video from several months back. You know, Adam Gadon, Azam the supposed Al-Qaeda grandson of ADL operative. AA quick bail bonding out of Plano, Texas, Googled drug trafficking in Bolivia. Cobalt Group, an automotive group out of Seattle, Washington, Googled Oregon weapons armory. Our aforementioned AIG, American International Group, out of the Bronx, Googled, oh, wouldn't you know it, Vigilant Shield 09. Huh, what a surprise that groups like that are keeping an eye on terror drills. Australian Stock Exchange out of New South Wales, Sydney, was visiting, as was George Washington University. They're reading about how the FBI was caught running a top Nazi group. U.S. Department of Transportation, with, of course, always their interesting ISP, uscg.mil, the U.S. Department of Transportation out of Washington, D.C., Googled press report for Enviro Health Corp. And then that didn't work, but they still hit a link on MediaMonarchy.com. Then they tried press report for Enviro Health Corp, Kansas. And then that didn't work, but they still hit a link to MediaMonarchy.com anyway. And then for a third time, they finally tried Enviro Health Corp annual reports. And I guess that seemed to do the trick for the U.S. Department of Transportation. It's interesting I use the term Enviro Health just as a subheading for anything doing with the environment or health or science. So I smashed a word together and it gets great results. On Google, that is. Of course, the Navy Network Information Center was visiting out of Arlington. Department of Homeland Security out of Springfield, Virginia, Googled, was Obama selected to be president? Yes, he was. Loyola University out of New Orleans Googled Alex Ansari, number 175. Of course, mentioning outside the box. Honeywell International, private military industrial complex contractors out of Phoenix, Arizona. They hit me up from my often hit link, thanks to Mike Rivero, on whatreallyhappened.com. And, of course, the mysterious death of 9/11 eyewitness Barry Jennings. The Ford Motor Company out of Dearborn, Michigan, the Defense Contract Management Agency, DCMA.mil, out of Alexandria, the Department of Justice out of Metairie, Louisiana, the U.S. House of Representatives, and finally, the Asian Institute of Technology out of Bangkok, Thailand. Those are just some of the interesting visitors to MediaMonarchy.com in just the past week. The downloads on the episodes are going up and up and up. The hits on the website seem to be going up and up and up. I thank you. I appreciate it. It means a lot. Please don't get mad at me if I don't respond always to the notes that you send me on Instant Messenger or on Yahoo or on MySpace or on FaceSpace or God knows what. I love you guys. Thanks for getting in touch with me. You can find me on MediaMonarchy.com, MediaMonarchy@Yahoo.com. I am in Skype, RadioForAll.net, iTunes, Archive.org, MySpace, Dig, YouTube.com/MediaMonarchy. There's any number of ways. Please get in touch with me. We shall get through this. We shall open the eyes and the ears of people who are drinking the Obama-sia Kool-Aid right now. And it's really starting to get to me. And we're going to find a way to get through this. It's not that hard. If you just run some searches, you would figure out you're projecting your change onto this man, and he is going to disappoint you. I forget where I heard it the other day, but it was probably off The Simpsons. But, oh, God, it's a shame we won't be around for you to hear me say, I told you so. All right. That's it. The next time you hear me is going to be episode 100 of MediaMonarchy.com. I think I have a special in-studio guest lined up next Friday, November 21st, 2008, the day before the 45th anniversary of the Black Op assassination, broad daylight, high noon death of a president, JFK, 45 years ago. But I don't know yet. It's not confirmed completely. One way or the other, it's going to be a hell of an episode, 100 of MediaMonarchy.com. I hope you will join me. I hope you will tell other people about MediaMonarchy.com. I love you. Thank you. Like my man, Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
It's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Same.
On my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.